We get it. After all the frustration, the endless cycles of hoping for a system that actually works, you're ready for something steady. Something that delivers without constant workarounds or headaches. That's why we're excited to introduce the 2025 redesign of the Buzz CRM. Built with you in mind, it's more intuitive, faster, and smarter than ever. Finally, a CRM that sees your worth, streamlines your workflows, and gives you the tools to thrive without needing to prove yourself over and over again. Because you deserve a lifeline after all those outdated platforms. You deserve a system that keeps up with your goals and grows with your success. This isn't just a redesign, it's a revolution. Visit thebuzzcrm.com today. That's thebuzzcrm.com.
Memorial Day doorbuster deals are here at Lowe's. Right now, rewards members save $80 on the Master Forge 4-burner gas grill, now just $149. Plus, rewards members save $900 on the Lowe's exclusive Hisense French door refrigerator, now only $999. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 5/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Programs subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Welcome back to Blown Business here on CannabisRia.com. Thank you all for joining us here on the program. Once again, we're going to go back into another legal discussion. And we'll be talking about the areas between the intersection between cannabis and alcohol today with our guest, Zachary Coburn, transactional and regulatory attorney at Saul Ewing LLP. But before we do that, we must tell you that Blunt Business is brought to you and presented by thebuzzcrm.com because it is the one place to get yourself organized. Emails, calls, texts, everything. You want AI help, you want the ability to go and have all modules of whatever you've been using for platforms and then insert it into all in one place, one platform, one CRM. Intuitive workflows. It's easy to go and use and a very low barrier to entry. I have said this before. And we're going to be doing webinars very soon. Keep and listen right here to this program when we tell you about the next webinar we'll have for you to go ahead and get under the hood and learn more about the Buzz CRM because you need to get it for yourself. 2025 is a very tough year. You want to make sure that all your ducks are in a row. You want to be able to micromanage all your resources and be able to put it in one platform without excessive subscriptions and logins you don't want to go ahead and keep up on. You want to be able to get your whole team connected and converged in one place. Go to thebuzzcrm.com, thebuzzcrm.com, learn more, and tell them the Blunt Business sent you. So on the program today, once again, a seasonal transactional regulatory attorney with extensive experience in the cannabis industry. He has served as general counsel for major cannabis operators, notably leading and managing a $2.1 billion acquisition to propel the company to be one of the largest cannabis operators in the United States. His expertise encompasses structuring high-value deals, navigating complex regulatory frameworks, and advising companies on growth strategies in the evolving beverage and cannabis markets. I welcome back Zachary Coburn. Thanks, Zach.
Thank you, George. Thanks for having me. I think I'm going to take you everywhere I go for that intro.
Yeah, and I just went quick on that. If give me the time like to actually project it would be really great. Now, let's get into this. So there's a lot that's been said when it comes to cannabis and alcohol. There's, you know, the ongoing legitimization, you know, the thought of where alcohol and cannabis can be put on the same shelves. The Prairie News in San Jose actually put out a story, and it's just spitting out facts, how the mainstream view alcohol and cannabis. And just to go and just put down, view alcohol and marijuana, they say. But either which way, they put stats in there and you just drop it. Quote, we're seeing a clear trend of cannabis and alcohol industries converging, particularly with companies exploring hemp-derived beverages. That's more the trend now these days. We've talked about the extensive times where Pepsi or Starbucks or Constellation Brands that have all converged in making cannabis-related beverages. And this is driven in part by evolving consumer preferences, especially among younger generations who are showing a decline in traditional alcohol consumption. So, Zach, and this is, we're seeing it a lot. Gen Z, we hear a lot more where it's mocktails, it's more cannabis or hemp-driven beverages that are an opt of alcohol. And so how do you see the long-term sustainability of this convergence, especially considering potential for shifting regulatory landscapes and inherent volatility of consumer trends? And what's critical for these converging companies to ride the crest of cannabis becoming much more popular or coming to the level of alcohol consumption?
So There's a lot of questions in there. Let's try to unpack it.
Sure.
But the simple answer is none of it is surprising if you look at the entire chess board, and it's almost a matter of time, right? Like, I think you hit the nail on the head. Younger generations aren't drinking alcohol as much. I think coming out of COVID, you know, there was this, you know, heavy tequila, heavy bourbon push. But the younger professionals, that millennial Gen Z group, that they're just not drinking alcohol as much. So they're looking for alternatives. Alternatives that maybe are, you know, I don't want to say healthier, but have different or less health risks, that potentially have less side effects, you know, getting hungover, things like that. So that's kind of the first thing. You know, one of the interesting things that I've always talked about is the biggest impediment to, and this is kind of like a left turn, but like the biggest impediment to expansion from cannabis operators in the cannabis industry has really always been, in my opinion, or one of the biggest has been the stock exchanges, New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, right? You know, and because currently under the current rules, if you are a plant touching operator in the United States, plant touching marijuana operator in the United States, you can't list there, right? So the fact that the hemp side has now grown exponentially, I mean, think about a company like Coke, right? Coke owns, at least I think they do, you know, Vitamin Water, Smart Water, Coconut Water, and I'm sure they've got an energy drink somewhere in there. Why wouldn't this next pivot be like something that a company like Coke would move into? Or think about like Anheuser-Busch or Molson Coors, right? In the last 10 years, we've seen this explosion of, it's not even like a niche segment, but it's an entirely new segment of this kind of seltzer, fruited kind of canned beverage, you know, the Trulies of the world. And, you know, nowadays it's like you're seeing every beer company has a seltzer spritzer. Every juice company is coming out with some kind of alcoholic beverage, right? So this kind of thought of like these hemp-derived beverages fits perfectly within that model, right? Like you're not looking at, and we may get there someday, but we're not talking about distilled beverages. We're not talking about, you know, brewed, we're not talking about, you know, beer and wine or liquor. You know, these are essentially seltzers, right? So, you know, High Noon, Truly, those kind of model. You know, so to me, it makes perfect sense. It's a growing segment of the population that wants an alternative, right? So if you're a beer or alcohol company, or if you're a beverage company in general, to me, it would make perfect sense to get into it. Now, if you're a cannabis company, it makes even more sense, right? Because, you know, the one thing that most cannabis operators want to be prepared for, or at least are striving to get to, is a point where there can be interstate commerce, where we're not living in the state-by-state regulated market, right? And these beverages are a perfect example. You know, they are, compared to propping up, say, a new state where you're going to spend millions of dollars before you even get a product on the shelf, you can likely get these products, these drinks, these beverages to market relatively quickly and in a much more, you know, economical manner. And you do it in a way that essentially opens up a nationwide distribution network for you. So if you're a cannabis company or you're a hemp company, you know, it's a real no-brainer. Now, the downside is the regulatory issues, right? Amongst a number of other things, right? You know, it's some states have like fully embraced this. You know, you look at a state like Minnesota, you know, where they view this and they're treating it basically like alcohol distribution sales. Other states have taken a more hands-off approach, you know, and then there are trends like you're seeing in Texas where they're trying to just ban everything. So the unknown is kind of all over the map, you know, and then the federal side, what's really kind of confusing is this is kind of like the early days of cannabis, where, you know, the federal government hasn't legalized it, but the federal government's taken a hands-off approach, right? Like drinks kind of would fall under the FDA and the Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act. And the federal government has said that, you know, cannabis is not a permitted, or hemp is not a permitted additive in foods, in a food source. But they've taken a bit of a hands-off approach. So,
but, you know, that's a good question to point out. Why is it that when it comes to consumables versus, you know, smokable flower or, you know, dabs or whatever, why there isn't a distinction between saying why the ATF doesn't regulate cannabis in that respect? Because that would be a part of the market if it was allowed. You know, I mean, if, you know, in the same way alcohol is being regulated for the content by volume, the same thing could be done with cannabis-related beverages or hemp-related beverages. Why hasn't that ever been split up?
I think it's because of a lot of things. One, I think it's because the federal government can't get its act straight, right? Like, they don't know how to regulate this.
Well, they don't want to regulate. Let's put it like this. The rescheduling that we have right now with the DEA continues to be delayed. I know there was another hearing, which was already delayed before from last week, or as it was March 14th. We were supposed to go and have another meeting that maybe the judge with the DEA was actually going to finally give us a ruling, or at least further along the cause. But we haven't gotten to that yet. That's just an example of kicking the can down the road. Same thing with the FDA hemp bill.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's. I don't think they want to regulate this. Sorry, I have something in my eye.
Yeah.
I don't think they want to regulate.
Take 10 seconds. We'll get in. I want to take that out. Sorry.
I don't think they want to regulate it.
The best piece of financial advice I've ever received is to pay yourself first. That's why now with every paycheck I receive, I start by putting a little bit away for those rainy days. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified portfolio that can help you weather all of the market's ups and downs. Using Acorns, before I knew it, I had a couple $1,000s in a little nest egg account. Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM.
Kick off summer with Memorial Day savings at Lowe's. Right now, get 5 Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. Plus, get up to 40% off select major appliances and save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/28. Mulch offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
I don't think they've realized the mindset. You know, so like 6 years ago, I was in Israel and we were talking with the like folks in the agriculture ministry and their research and development folks, and the amount of work and effort they put in the front end to come up with new products, pharmaceutical products, consumable goods. And somebody over there pointed out to me that a country like Israel focused so much on R&D, but never figured out how to commercialize the products. And they said that in the context of the United States went the exact opposite. When it comes to cannabis or hemp, the United States went straight to commercializing it, and they never figured out the front end, the R&D, or how things work, right? So, you know, we live in a world from a regulatory framework where, you know, food and drinks are regulated by one group. And alcohol is regulated by another group, and healthcare products are regulated by another agency. Because the U.S. went straight to commercializing cannabis, and by cannabis I mean hemp and marijuana, cannabis products, it's not like the federal government caught up and went, oh, shoot, HHS needs to handle this, and FDA needs to handle this. They haven't figured it out. And, you know, now it's kind of at the point where it's like, how do you put all that toothpaste back in the tube so you can allocate it amongst the right agencies? So you're right. Yeah. Like in the perfect world, should hemp beverages be regulated the same way that beer and wine are? 100%. Would it make so much more sense? Absolutely. But then you get into the question of, well, what's different between that and, you know, other consumables, smokable products, or, you know, ingestible products, things like that. So I think there's just a lot of confusion at the regulatory level, federal and state, and no one has kind of figured out the best path forward. You know, and it also doesn't help that the science is so far ahead, right? I mean, like, I know this is off the topic with drinks, but like, you know, a year or two ago, it was all THCA, and states started pushing hard against THCA. So now we're seeing, you know, HHC, THCP, and other cannabinoids that are stepping out, right? I think the science has moved so far ahead that no one has ever, that regulators haven't really figured out, okay, how do we control everything in a way that makes sense? I would love if, hell, I would love it if marijuana were regulated the same way, you know, beer and alcohol were, you know, kind of that model. But I don't see that happening right.
But there's got to be something good against them. Now, what I can see is, let's go into a little bit of an update for listeners out there. So President Trump has nominated former Virginia state official and DEA officer Terrence Cole. No relation to James Cole, the deputy attorney that wrote the Cole memorandum. Let's make sure to clear that up. But that's being done right now, and he will head the DEA. That's what the plan is if he gets nominated and gets confirmed. So they're trying to say that, you know, his stances are really, it was more of a just say no campaign. He often referred to that. He's not, wasn't pro-cannabis, they said, to that point. And it's unclear if his reschedule will be in the nomination hearing to come, if it'll be brought up. And, you know, we know the Trump administration is talking about researching and rescheduling medical cannabis use as currently the run-up to the 2024 election. But that's where we're at right now. But that's something that also comes into play. But we have nothing yet from the DEA judge, nothing yet from the legalization front or a rescheduling front at all. The last thing I had was, what, 5 days ago, Perkins Coie, the counsel for DEA, the DEA hearing process, was booted out of the hearings. So I don't know what comes on with that. But is there anything you can give me at all in terms of what's being said between legal circles about what's happening with the DEA and the folks that are trying to go ahead and get in front of them to speak on behalf of cannabis?
I don't think, and this gets to a larger political spectrum, but look, I can't speak for colleagues, but I'm not confident that this process is going to be moved at anything more than a glacial speed. You know, it's sad, it's unfortunate. But also, the reality is that the process to reschedule a drug will typically take 3, 4, 5 years, right? Unfortunately. And I think there was a real urgency to push this process forward under a previous administration, even though, you know, the Biden administration was not super friendly.
But the administrative law judge that's overseeing this was, I don't know if he was appointed prior to, but he was already part of the proceedings prior to the Trump administration taking office.
Yeah. I don't think there is as much urgency from the Trump administration. Look, if the president really wanted to make this happen, he'd tell the DEA to get it done. Right? Like, that's as simple as that. Like, there's, so I just don't think, I think they've got a number of other priorities that they're focusing on, which is, you know, understandable but unfortunate. You know, I just don't see this happening until maybe later 2025.
Yeah, so, I mean, for anybody that was thinking they were going to be able to go right off their taxes for 2025, you'll have to skip maybe till next year, most likely. And maybe on top of that, anything for research purposes, all that's going to get held up. But we have to take into consideration, we still have a nomination processes. Like, it's so Terrence Cole was nominated on February 11th, but I believe, I don't know at this point as of press time, if he's been confirmed or not, because the process for everything else has been going into play. So don't know about that yet, but we're waiting and we have no answer for this yet. So in the big ticket, the big picture sense, seeing some extra relief, I'm not going to go and burden you with that. And I can't burden the listeners with it anymore because I think it just kind of gives people more into a buzzkill or a killjoy more than anything. And I don't have a good answer for it. I thought they would have gotten this done by now, but, you know, this administrative law judge, I don't know, and there's not another set time as to when another hearing is scheduled, because I think it's just been pushed back at least 90 days from the January something or other hearing that was scheduled. Pushed back, pushed back. So we don't have anything yet in terms of when another hearing is going to be scheduled. We have to wait on that.
And yeah, I said it was actually, I mean, it was, so when it came to rescheduling, I believe it's now, the judge delayed it indefinitely.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last thing we saw was the push from two or three of the related parties because they felt that the DEA was acting inappropriately. I'm totally paraphrasing it. And my good friend Shane Pennington would probably, you know, be furious at me for butchering the process. But I'm going to paraphrase it. But basically, the process was put on hold indefinitely.
Right.
And it's back in the DEA's hands at this point, right? Like, the DEA has to take a step. That's why I don't see the DEA doing much. Now, could the ALJ come back in and say, okay, DEA, you've got to actually do something? Yeah, 100%.
But there also be intervention from the HHS. I know that Bobby Kennedy Jr. right now being brought in, I know there's other things that might be prioritized, and this might be something that he has oversight with the DEA to intervene and to maybe make some point about where are we on this. But we don't have any word about that yet. And, of course, the media is not going to help us with that kind of information anyway. They're not going to ask the question about it. And then, you know, we're, I can't expect, you know.
Look, HHS can make noise, but they're, from a procedural standpoint, they can't move the ball. Like, yeah, can they make noise and put pressure on DEA? Yes.
Right.
At the end of the, you know, at the end of the day, kind of come back to, you know, if the president wanted to make this happen, the president could literally make this happen. Like, move the ball forward. Seriously.
But there's just other things that I think they're going to put in priority above this right here, which has been longstanding for a long time. I mean,
right.
It was all the timing of what, and this is where I said as well, the Biden administration, they could have done something a little bit sooner than this. They made attempts when it came to expunging federal offenses, when it came to this. Yeah. Okay. These are good steps going forward symbolically, but, like, you know, it was also the timing was more for political timing than it was actually like helping out the businesses out there in cannabis and some 15,000 dispensaries to be able to go ahead and get themselves operating and working with more revenue in their pocket to be able to go and work on an investment, which we'll talk about coming up after a break. We'll talk more about the areas of regulatory, because let's just work on the state by state issues we normally have and what can be done right now to help continue to make the industry thrive from a state by state basis. We'll talk about that. I'm here with Zachary Coben, transactional regulatory attorney at Saul Ewing LLP. Back after a short break with more. Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with Zachary Coben, transactional regulatory attorney at Saul Ewing LLP. It's going to move along into the major challenge in this space right now. There's, of course, regulation all over the within the states, some with varying, you know, similarities than others. Embracing cannabis and hemp-derived products, but still strict prohibitions. So I want to know from you, Saul, Zach, how companies are mitigating risks associated right now with state-by-state variances. Is there really out right now in terms of when it comes to mergers and acquisitions, when it comes to trying to grow some of these MSOs that want to go and continue to grow? You're in Florida like myself. I just started seeing that VitaCann locations are now being switched to Planet 13. I finally saw that come into play. They're finally getting themselves established.
Yeah.
But the thing is that the regulatory landscape, if there's any changes in between or changes, you know, from year to year that we don't even hear about, that where, you know, the ball can be consistently moved around as to what they need to be aware of so that they are above board with what they need to go and do.
Yeah, so I think you've got a couple ways of approaching it, right? So on the marijuana side, you know, think of it like companies effectively have a bunch of individual state-run companies, right? So you have a large MSO, and, you know, they have to operate effectively. If you have an MSO in 15 states, they're operating 15 different companies, each one with its own separate requirements, whether it's hiring, firing, ingredients, labeling, packaging, all of those things. You know, that requires expertise within each company to stay on top of it, whether it's outside lawyers or internal compliance managers or officers, or the like. So every state is a little different. So, you know, you have to kind of stay on top of that. So mitigating your risk there is, you know, I mean, look, I've been in-house twice, and I'm a firm believer in having a very robust compliance operation within your company to make sure that you are understanding the regulatory landscape, understanding what works and what doesn't work. Look, I've worked with countless regulators across the country, and, you know, there are some people that look at regulators and go straight to piss and vinegar and want to fight on everything. I'm the kind of lawyer that you know, I advise clients, sometimes honey goes a lot farther than vinegar. You know, you have to understand the people that are paid to regulate. Most of the time, regulators are underpaid, under-resourced, and have way more things going on. They're just trying to check things off a list. So if you understand your audience, you can develop your program and your platform to satisfy the requirements of that audience. That's on a state-by-state level, right? So, you know, when it comes to hemp, hemp's a little interesting because there are certain federal regulations, but there's also state-by-state regulations. You know, when it comes to hemp clients, because they're able to transport products across state lines and, you know, manufacture something in Florida and turn around and sell it in Ohio or Illinois or wherever, you know, what I typically try and advise them is find the most restrictive state that you are likely going to be operating in. And in most instances, those regulations for hemp kind of fall in the dealing with additives, ingredients, colors, as well as, you know, packaging and labeling. You know, find the most restrictive and work backwards from that, right? Like, so, if you know that you are primarily going to be in 20 selling through distributors in 25 states, what's the most restrictive process, you know, state regulatory you're going to be in, and work backwards when it comes to your packaging and what you can and can't do. Otherwise, you're going to effectively be making products on a state-by-state basis. Most of the hemp manufacturers don't want to do that, nor can they afford to do that. If the bulk of the states all have rules somewhere around the realm of you can't have packaging that's enticing to children, you know, you kind of find it's a little extra work on the front end, but you find what the common denominator is in the regulations, right? So say the majority of states say you can't use bright, shiny, fluorescent colors for your packaging. Then you don't use bright, shiny, fluorescent colors for your packaging. You know what I mean? So I think it's doing a little more work on the front end, finding what is the, you know, the lowest barrier to entry into the hardest state and work that way. There are some states where they just don't care. There's minimal regulation, and that's okay. Those aren't the states to worry about. It's the states that are like, you know, oh, you've got a picture of someone's hand on your package. That's a body part. Therefore, it's, you know, considered enticing to children. Which is 100% accurate. That's something Florida does. I think you kind of take from a regulatory perspective that approach. I also think there's something to be said about not hiving the eight ball. Years ago, you know, cannabis companies felt like, you know, we had to almost hide what was done and not done. I think that's the wrong approach. You know, I tell people with regulators, you got to be honest with regulators. You got to be upfront with regulators, but you only give them what they want and what they need. right? You don't want to open up more questions, more issues with regulators. So there is a learned art form, I guess, a learned process with how you deal with regulators. You know, some, like I said, some states are much more, you know, they put up a brick wall and they don't want to deal with you, and, you know, they're not going to be receptive. And there are other states where you can get on the phone with a regulator and they'll walk you through everything. You know, my approach that I've always held with clients when dealing with regulators is, you know, to literally tell the regulator straight out, you know, what do we need to do to make your job easier? Simple. Like, if you can simplify it there, right, it makes things a lot easier.
What are the long into the areas of financial? So at the moment, there's been a couple of things that have been talked about when it comes to several GOP lawmakers actually kind of doing a little bit of due diligence when it comes to trying to bring forward the conversation about cannabis and banking. Senator Tim Scott's actually been taking debating statements from various companies like FlowHub and others about these businesses and trying to get banking services, trying to get banking help. Another GOP Congressman, Warren Davidson, last month in Ohio, he raised the issue to members as part of a Senate banking committee. And there's been on both sides conversation about the fact that they do address the lack of financial services across access for cannabis businesses. And one GOP member suggested the issue warrants a broader examination. They're just talking. So it's still more we need to go into. The Brookings Institution's Aaron Klein addressed the banking issue and wrote and submitted testimony where he recommended the committee, you know, either combine safe banking with broader reform or enhance safe banking to address the problem with SARs falling on state licensed cannabis businesses. Can you clarify what that means right there, what he meant by Aaron Klein about what this combination would be, and would it move any further up the chain to make lawmakers pass the bill?
Warren Davidson, I think, has always been an advocate. You know, I think he filed a bill in the House a couple of years ago dealing with insurance. So, you know, I know he's always been an advocate. I think you're correct. To a certain extent, it's opportunistic. You know, politicians by nature are a bit opportunistic.
What is it? The same banking committee that also passed the Safe Banking Act through committee to get it to Congress, but nothing ever happened to it. Just fell on deaf ears.
Yeah, I mean, typically it's died in the Senate. Look, when it comes to safe banking, like, I'm a big believer that the idea of safe banking does more than what the actual bill will do, right? Like, safe banking is not going to open the floodgates to have big banks banking cannabis, right? Like, the reality is that's just not going to happen. Are there other things in safe banking that could potentially create, you know, better opportunities? Yeah, you know, versions of safe banking, you know, would make insurance access a lot easier, would make investment access a lot easier, you know, would potentially make it clearer for banks on when they do and do not have to file suspicious activity reports. Sorry. But safe banking will not change rescheduling. Safe banking will not on its own open up the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ to list. Safe banking may, but will not require branded card networks to allow. And safe banking is not going to change the compliance requirements that banks have to undergo from their regulators in order to bank cannabis. So, like, those that sit there and go, oh, if safe banking passes, the cost for a cannabis company to be banked by a financial institution will come down. That's probably not true, because that bank still has to hire, you know, 3 to 4 compliance officers, you know, to satisfy all the requirements that the banking regulators want. So the idea of safe banking is great, but at its core, safe banking, you know, it's not the world, you know, it's not the end all be all, right? And I'm not saying that to be just like a complete downer on the bill, more realistic, but there's also an aspect to safe banking that the fact that anything can be done, you know, the cannabis industry has operated in such a way for so long where everybody's against it, yet they've done it in spite of that, right? Like, You've got an industry that's worth worldwide, what, $40 billion? In the U.S. probably employs over 450,000 people. And that's all in spite of the fact that the federal government has been none helpful. So I think the idea of safe banking and, you know, beyond what's the actual language in the bill, but it's the fact of like, will Congress actually do something that benefits the industry, right? That's a larger symbolic aspect that is extremely important.
Well, right. And the other thing too is that where I look at this is that it's still money that the cannabis companies want. If they could try to recoup money from the rescheduling that we expected the EA to do at some point, or have safe banking allow us to go ahead and have banks to offer capital that they can go ahead and either get through loans or either get through other investments so they can get some capital. That's all that matters really right now. And I feel like it's almost like a desperate attempt because the cannabis industry just needs more money to continue to flux into their businesses to keep moving forward. And that's what I think is being stalled out right now. That's what I think companies are feeling like.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I'll say it again. Like, to me, the biggest impediment to the cannabis industry moving forward has been the stock exchanges not allowing plain touching companies, right? The amount of capital that potentially will open up is dramatic, right? You know, the opportunity for the Veranos and the True Leaves and the Cure Leaves and you know, whoever else to uplist out of the Canadian exchanges into a U.S. exchange will open up a lot more. But on the other side of that, you know, when you think about it, the largest cannabis company in the world right now, the largest companies in the world are still smaller than most of the smallest pharmaceutical companies, right? So the amount of capital it would require for big pharma, big tobacco, big ag, big CPG to be involved in the cannabis industry, it's nominal, right? Like, it's like the amount of money, I joke with people all the time, the amount of money it would take to prop up a state operation in Ohio or, you know, Illinois or wherever, Arizona, is like the petty cash account for a VP at Glaxo. You know what I mean? So like, that to me, so you're spot on that the access to capital is the, like, bar none, one of the most important issues. And that's not to minimize others. It's just to say that it opens up so many more opportunities when these companies have more capital. You know, just look at what we saw coming out of COVID, right? COVID was great for cannabis companies. And, you know, they had money. They hired more people. They paid better. They expanded into new states. All in spite of the fact that the federal government still has not permitted it, right? So, you know, if there's any part of safe banking or any bill that potentially allows for new access to capital, then it's 100% a positive, right? Like, if there was a way that safe banking opened up better credit facilities, 100% great. If it opened up a pathway for branded card networks to allow these companies to use it, 100%. But, like, you know, the fact that there are executives at these cannabis companies that have lost bank accounts at Bank of America, Wells Fargo, wherever, and these are people that make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, lead teams of hundreds and thousands of people, and, you know, and lead companies that are worth more than probably half the companies on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. So it's kind of ironic. It's almost comical how stupid that it sounds, right? Like, if I said to you, you're the CEO of a company that's worth $1 billion, you make, you know, $500,000 to $1 million a year, and you've had to switch banks of your bank account 3 times, like, that's insane, right? Yeah. You know, it's just like, that makes no sense. We're not talking about, we're not talking about illegal drug dealers. We're talking about people running big companies. So your point is 100% correct. right? Like, if it in any way opens up access to new capital, then it's a good thing.
Let's go ahead and go to one more commercial break. When we come back again with Zachary Coburn for Saul Ewing LLP, back with final questions after this. Welcome back. I'm here on Blunt Business with Zachary Coburn, transactional regulatory attorney at Saul Ewing LLP. Final question real quick, Zach, before we wrap things up. So with hemp-derived beverages, we didn't get a chance to talk too much about hemp, but we know there's been a lot of things when it comes to, you know, the regulation of intoxicating hemp and trying to get that off of shelves, or if it's Delta 8, Delta 9, synthetic, things like that when it comes to beverages. You know, talk about any regulatory market challenges you see right now for this particular specific segment, which is not under the normal regulation for like cannabis would be, but you know, considerations when a company wants to go ahead and go into it and go hemp derived.
So to me, the hemp derived side is the massive opportunity, right? It's quick to market. It's easier to produce than the marijuana side. I think I mentioned before, you know, it creates a national framework, a national distribution model. You know, you have openly beer and alcohol distributors in multiple states are embracing it and are distributing it. You've got national box, you know, big box stores like Total Wine that are doing it. So that's 100% the avenue. The science is what makes this brilliant, right? Like, I don't think anyone years ago conceived the idea of, hey, you can take CBD, isomerize it through, you know, a chemical process, can convert it into Delta 9 or into THC. Or you can take another cannabinoid that gives you the same impact as Delta 9. You know, so like when you go to the store and it says THC beverage, that's what it is. These are hemp beverages. These are Farm Bill compliant beverages. These are products that are not marijuana, that, you know, and yes, there is a entire segment of the world that thinks once you convert it, it becomes marijuana or something, but that's not what the law said right now. Look, I tell people all the time that, do I think that this is one of those things that potentially has staying power? Yes. Do I think that you can bank your entire business on it? No. I think when it comes to the hemp-derived beverages, you capitalize as fast and as much as you can, knowing that, you know, I don't think that the Farm Bill, whenever they pass it in 2026 probably, is going to close the THC, the hemp loophole. But, you know, are they going to make certain things more difficult, right? Could they ban HHC or other types of cannabinoids or make it more specific? Yes. Do I think the science is such that people will figure out ways to work around it? 100%. So do I think it's going away? No.
No. Where two is that the FDA is actually looking to go ahead and possibly offer regulation and some guidance now on CBD itself, which... I don't know where that's going to come from, but that's Janet Woodcock, the deputy commissioner and leader of the agency's cannabis regulation efforts. They say there's concern about the safety of CBD and current regulatory pathways for food and dietary supplements if they're suitable for the substance. But again, you said the FDA hemp bill was kind of extended for another year, kicked the can down the road. Still no implementation, any regulations, anything considered like, oh, why don't you just drop the Cosmetic Act of 1930 and say, okay, there's a regulation. That's what you got to do. Start enforcing. But yeah, you don't do anything. Yeah. It's no answer yet. Right?
No, there are some things that we know they're looking at. Like, I think they just sent a notice to a company that does IV therapy for CBD. Okay,
yes.
It'd be interesting to see how that plays out. I think one of the ways that, look, if the FDA really wanted to get involved with this beyond the cannabis side, they would look at the additives, right? I mean, technically, under federal law, right now it's federal policy that cannabis and hemp is not a permissible additive. If they wanted to enforce it, they really could, but they're not.
All right, well, we got to leave it there. Zach, thank you so much for being on with us really quickly. You know, I know there's a lot of ground to cover, but it's like, what do I do with a lawyer? Like, we just kind of complain. Like, what are we doing here, man? This is all sucks. This all is like, man, oh my God, man, we can't get anything done. This is a struggle session.
Listen,
it was a struggle session on Blunt Business. I'm going to just say it right now. And I know all of you went along with this, but you know what? You're feeling the same pain as us, the same frustration. Let's just make it.
This is where I tell people all the time. People call me because they know that I am the smartest man in the room and that I know everything. No, I'm just kidding. I'm nowhere near the smartest man in the room. I just understand it. I understand it in a way that I could potentially, you know, help decipher it to those that need help. And yeah, look, if I had all the answers, I'd be living in a bigger house, doing a lot more with my life. But
this has been a rough year doing this show, Zach. Oh my goodness. It's like, can I get some positive, some sunshine here? Let's get some Summit Uplands over here. Let's get something like a little bit of ray of sunshine here. It's clouds all over the place.
You're doing great.
Well, we do it
live, man. Call me Chicken Little. Oh my goodness. This is crazy. Saul.com, SAUL.com. There's a good domain name for Saul Ewing LLP. And take one minute real quickly just to talk to people about why that should go ahead and work with you and your team.
I mean, listen, we've got we're a national firm. We are, over 450 lawyers spread out across the country. We have, one of the things I love about this firm is that we are extremely youthful. We're extremely exciting. We cover a number of different areas when it comes to cannabis and those and cannabis and hemp issues. We have a massive team across the country, whether it's regulatory, transactional, M&A, securities, litigation, IP, we know how to work with companies, big and small, and we do. We work with some of the biggest and work with, just pure startups. We've got decades of experience combined behind our entire team. We pride ourselves at being at the forefront of a number of issues, not just cannabis related, but issues that affect companies and the legal community at whole. We pride ourselves at being at the forefront of that. And, we want to be available. We want to help companies and clients move forward.
Zach Coben, the transactional regulatory attorney with Saul Ewing LLP. Again, the website is SAUL.com. Zach, thanks for being on. As always, of course, we'll keep the door open. We'll guys do another struggle session like this again. But I'm hoping next time we do this, we're going to get some real progress going on.
I'm always here to vent too, George. It's okay.
Thank you, Zach. And thank you, listeners, for listening to The Blunt Business. We'll talk to you next time. We get it. After all the frustration, the endless cycles of hoping for a system that actually works, you're ready for something steady. Something that delivers without constant workarounds or headaches. That's why we're excited to introduce the 2025 redesign of the Buzz CRM. Built with you in mind, it's more intuitive, faster, and smarter than ever. Finally, a CRM that sees your worth, streamlines your workflows, and gives you the tools to thrive without needing to prove yourself over and over again. Because you deserve a lifeline after all those outdated platforms. You deserve a system that keeps up with your goals and grows with your success. This isn't just a redesign, it's a revolution. Visit thebuzzcrm.com today. That's thebuzzcrm.com.
Memorial Day doorbuster deals are here at Lowe's. Right now, rewards members save $80 on the Master Forge 4-burner gas grill. Now just $149. Plus, rewards members save $900 on the Lowe's exclusive Hisense French door refrigerator. Now only $999. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 5/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.